case against John Joyner. Mr. Blakeman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I spoke to anyone who practices in the area of doing drug cases. This case is entirely predictable that it's here in the post-Booker world. What happened in this case is that the district court categorically rejected the 100-to-1 ratio that Congress has mandated of crack to powder, and instead adopted a sentencing its own preferred ratio of 20-to-1 and imposed sentence according to its own ratio. What the practical effect of that was in this case was, instead of a sentence under the advisory sentencing guidelines of 135 to 168 months, the court crafted the 20-to-1 ratio and sentenced the defendant at a 70 to 87 month ratio, ultimately imposing the sentence of 87 months. I think it's important to look at the background of this particular case, because these are the instances that the court alluded to in sentencing this defendant. In this case, Mr. Joyner made 3 sales of crack cocaine to an undercover police officer on 3 different occasions. On one of the occasions, Mr. Joyner informed the undercover police officer that if Mr. Joyner found out that he was the police, he would kill him and go to jail for murder and dope. While Mr. Joyner was doing these sales of crack cocaine to this undercover police officer, he was also on probation for possession of cocaine. And then while Mr. Joyner was in the process of being arrested as a result of a traffic stop, he resisted arrest, pushed one of the police officers out of the way, fled, and engaged in conduct which the district court found to constitute reckless endangerment during the flight. And then finally, Mr. Joyner, in a post-arrest statement, admitted that he had been dealing crack cocaine and cocaine since 2001. His arrest was in 2004. He indicated that during that time he had amassed between 4 and 5 kilograms of cocaine, which he himself cooked into crack cocaine, and he subsequently distributed that cocaine. Since Mr. Joyner has been sentenced, 2 circuits have had the occasion to address this case. The First Circuit in the case of the United States against Foe, and the Fourth Circuit in the case of the United States against Europe. In both of those cases, the First Circuit and the Fourth Circuit held that the district court could not or was not permitted to change the congressional mandated ratio of 100-to-1 that's found in the mandatory minimums and varied in the guidelines, and sentence the defendant under a ratio other than that. For to do that would be making a policy decision, and that is what the district court did in this case.
In the statutory scheme, could you explain to me again, we've got a mandatory minimum. Is that a separate statute as apart from the course of sentencing guidelines?
Yes, sir.
So we have a 5-year mandatory minimum.
Yes. Anyone who possesses with the intent to distribute or distribute over 5 grams but less than 50 grams of crack cocaine is subject to a mandatory minimum of not less than 5 years and a sentence of not more than 40 years.
But the ratio of 100-to-1 is found in the sentencing guidelines?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
And not statutory?
Not statutory, but certainly reflecting the will of Congress. Congress has mandated that crack cocaine and powder cocaine are different. Indeed, this court on a number of occasions has upheld the differential, the 100-to-1 differential, on many, many grounds.
I understand it, but I'm just trying to. Congress did not pass a law saying 100-to-1, didn't put it in a mandatory minimum statute, for example. Rather, said, Sentencing Commission, we want you to put 100-to-1 in your guidelines, right?
Well, what happened, Your Honor, as the guidelines, as they were enacted in 1987, the Sentencing Commission...
Well, remember when they were...
...adopted the 100-to-1 ratio in the drug quantity table to mirror Congress's intent to reflect the differential between crack and powder. But it is not a statute. That was delegated to the Sentencing Commission.
And that part. So how does that... we're dealing with congressional intent rather than congressional enactment.
I believe that's true, Your Honor. What the district court has done has gone against the will of Congress. The will of Congress is that crack cocaine and powder cocaine be treated differently and that they be treated at a ratio of 100-1. Indeed, as the court is no doubt aware, the Sentencing Commission has on numerous occasions sent recommendations to Congress to either do away with the ratio or change the ratio.
What do we do now that the sentencing guidelines are advisory only?
As far as, Your Honor?
Any of the content of the 101.
I think what the First Circuit in Foe and the Fourth Circuit in Ure found was that sentencing and setting the penalties for criminal offenses is within the purview of Congress. I'm not suggesting that.
But they normally do that by statute.
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? Congress would normally do that by statute.
And it may very well be that Congress does ultimately address this problem by enacting a statute. My understanding is that they are monitoring what's going on as far as sentences.
We all know that. We all know that we're under a lot of scrutiny on this. We have to decide this case according to the law. Now, is the position of the government that a district judge can never sentence using a ratio other than the 100-1 in any case?
As it relates of crack to powder?
Yes.
I believe that until Congress acts and changes that ratio, which they're certainly free to do, that is what the guidelines are.
Can the United States District Judge say, I understand the ratio is 100-1, and go ahead and calculate the guideline sentence using the guidelines as they exist, 100-1 ratio, and then say, I do not think that in this particular case, for the following reasons, that ratio is an appropriate benchmark for sentencing, and therefore I'm going to sentence at a far lower sentence than the 100-1. Can he do that?
I think it's certainly clear to me that in the post-Booker rule, Your Honor, a district court need not sentence a defendant under the guidelines and can certainly vary under the guidelines for individual reasons that pertain to an individual defendant and an individual case. But that's not what we have in this case. In this case, the only reason that the record reflects that the district court varied from the guidelines, what amounts to a sixth-level variance from the guidelines, is that the district court was under the impression that the 100-1 ratio should not be the policy. The district court made a policy call.
So the district court heard when it substituted its judgment for the judgment of the commission in Congress as to what the advisory level ought to be.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
That was the error.
Yes, sir. Made a mistake of law.
If the district court had said, I acknowledge that, I calculated, as we have said he has to, do the calculation as part of the methodology. But once that's done, did he have the right to say, but I'm not going to hand down this sentence, the advisory sentence that he just calculated. I'm going to give a lower sentence.
If the district court's desire to vary from the guidelines is based solely on its disagreement with Congress's policy judgment that crack cocaine be treated at a ratio of 100-1 to powder.
As opposed to the facts and circumstances of the individual case.
Yes, sir.
Which you would have to set forth on the record so that we could review it and determine whether it was reasonable.
Yes, sir.
The concurrence in Europe goes through the scenario that Judge Griffin described. And it seems to me that in Europe it was the same problem, where the judge just disagreed with that ratio. But the concurrence went through an analysis of 3553A, if you applied a lot of those different principles in individuating the situation, then it could, but you would have to recite them all in some detail so that when we review it, we know that the departure, that it was reasonable not to follow the guidelines and in that particular case would be lower, a lot of times it's higher. Now, are you familiar with the concurrence in yours?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that a scenario that the government could agree with?
As long as there were individual factors that were spelled out, individual to the case and the defendant, and that the variance was not just on the district court's disagreement with the policy judgment that Congress made, I believe that this court could review a sentence for reasonableness.
Where you have to see those things set out. For instance, if somebody is sick or has cancer or has some other reason or was peripherally involved, lots of things that might mitigate. Of course, a lot of things under 3553A are not mitigating. They move the thing up. So they're aggravating, I guess. But at least that scenario is available. It's not a lockstep just because you didn't follow the guidelines. If someone says, I get through the policy, therefore I'm going to give lower, as opposed to, yes, I understand the policy, but here are the reasons why this is reasonable to go below or above.
Yes, Your Honor, as long as it wasn't a disagreement that the district court had with the policy, and that was the reason for the area so long.
It goes beyond. It says there are other reasons.
And
I'll recite all of those so that show that why it's reasonable not to follow that guideline.
Yes, and, as this court said in the Dean case, that the 3553A reasons don't need to all be spelled out, but there are scenarios under that construction. I believe there could be a variance with the guideline.
Didn't Judge McKinney in this case try to do that, and they say it was individual?
Your Honor, I went through the sentencing transcript many, many times, and in my reading of the sentencing transcript, all of the factors that he recited, that this defendant was on probation, that he'd been dealing for a long time, all are what could be termed as aggravating factors. He did say that this defendant was not an importer or an organizer, a street-level dealer, but I would respectfully suggest that in probably 13 years of prosecuting nothing but drug cases, most all of the cases are done on the street. I would also suggest that crack cocaine is not imported. It would be it's produced here domestically. And it's very difficult to have an organizer in a one-person, one-defendant case.
Well, he cooked it too, right?
He did cook it, absolutely, Your Honor. He admitted that he did. And he admitted that he cooked it, got multiple kilograms of it, and then put it out on the street.
Mr. Smithman, I corrected Judge McKinney's client to consider the relevant conduct.
He did decline to consider the relevant. He considered it, Your Honor, but he rejected it. And rather than holding this defendant responsible for between 4 and 5 kilograms of crack cocaine, he held the defendant responsible for 80 kilograms of crack cocaine and then reduced it even further by applying the 20-to-1 ratio that the court thought appropriate.
Thank you, Mr.
Cook. Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. McKinley.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is James McKinley. I'm with the Federal Defender's Office, and in 7 years with the Federal Defender's Office, I've never filed a brief with a red cover, and I've never had the opportunity to stand before this court and say the district court got it right. But it did do it. I understand the government's argument that the error claimed here is as to Judge McKinney's methodology in formulating the sentence. And they describe that methodology as reflecting a categorical policy-based rejection of congressional intent, and therefore the sentence was unreasonable as a matter of law. Well, it wasn't. What Judge McKinney did here is precisely what he was required to do under the relevant statutes and under the Supreme Court's holding in Booker. He started with 21 U.S.C. 841, which mandates a 5-year minimum sentence. Statutory range is 5 to 40. There's no question the sentence of 87 months here was within that range. He then turned to 3553, which requires the court to formulate and impose a sentence that's sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with the purpose of the sentence. After considering nature and circumstances of the offense, history and characteristics of the individual, the need to avoid unwarranted disparity, and of course, the sentencing guidelines, which is where he went next. he calculated the sentencing guidelines, the advisory range here, in a manner that's not in dispute between the parties. Level 32, criminal history category 3, generating a range of 135 to 168 months. He then went to the next level and emphasized on the record the importance of the history and characteristics of the individual and the importance of evaluating the nature and circumstances of the offense. He went on to assess what I would call the real offense conduct here, which involves an analysis that entails much more than just looking at the quantity of drugs and the nature of the drugs, that being crack cocaine in this case. An analysis that requires the court to assess such things as well, is this guy a high-level distributor that is out there motivated simply by profit, or is he a low-level street dealer who's out there feeding his own habit, which is what this case was. The court emphasized the significance that this particular defendant was a street-level dealer. There was no violence in this case. The court made no finding that there was credible threats of violence. There were no guns involved in the case. And the court then went on and had to assess whether those case-specific facts made this range sufficient or more than sufficient to comply with the purpose of sentencing. And Chief Judge McKinney was persuaded that the advisory guideline range was more than sufficient. Understand that the guideline range is subordinate to that parsimony principle in the first part of 3553A. The court is required to impose a sentence sufficient but not greater than necessary. That's the cap, over above in which no lawful sentence can be imposed. That is the limit. And the court was persuaded that the sentencing guideline range in this case was more than necessary. It was only then that he turned to the 20-to-1 ratio. And he looked at the ratio, made this other calculation, came out to a level 25, criminal history 3, generated a sentencing range of 70 to 87 months, and then on the record, analyzed whether that was sufficient. Was it sufficient to afford adequate deterrence? Was it sufficient to promote the other purposes of sentencing reflected in 3553A, and concluded that sentence at the high end, 87 months, that was sufficient. He concluded that was a just sentence in light of what this particular street dealer did, and it was a sentence consistent with the way he had seen similarly situated defendants involved in similar conduct and similar background sentenced in his court, sentenced within the Southern District of Indiana, and sentenced with in other jurisdictions around the country. The methodology here was, again, in every way compliant with the statutes and the holding in book. Now, let me just touch on this idea of congressional intent, because I know that this has been something that the government has suggested was violated here. The Sentencing Commission, in its most recent study, the 15-year study, made a recommendation that the 100-to-1 ratio be changed to a 20-to-1 ratio. Congress has not acted on that. Congress has done nothing in response to that recommendation. And I submit that this court should be reluctant to draw too much of an inference from Congress's failure to act. Congress has only expressed rejection of a prior commission recommendation occurred in response to the commission's recommendation or proposed amendment in 1995 that the 100-to-1 disparity be eliminated altogether, that crack and powder be treated identically. Congress expressly rejected that and noted that crack cocaine is more serious and should be treated more harshly. And by the way, Judge McKinney did treat Mr. Joyner more harshly than it had been powder cocaine. But the to adopt what the government is suggesting here, that this prior rejection of the Sentencing Commission's recommendation and Congress's current failure to enact or respond to the most recent 20-to-1 recommendation, to adopt that view, I think effectively returns the guidelines perilously close to becoming mandatory.
How did the First and Fourth Circuit treat that situation?
As I read the Fourth Circuit case and the Foe decision, and the companion case of the United States versus Lewis out of the First Circuit, this case, they didn't really get to discuss the parsimony clause. What they said is that yes, the 101 ratio is embedded not only in the guidelines but in the statute itself, because, for example, to trigger a 5-year mandatory minimum, it only requires 5 grams of crack cocaine, but 500 grams of powder cocaine. So it's embedded in the statute. And embedded in the guidelines, if you take it out of the guidelines, it creates a flattening effect as far as sentencing ranges are concerned. But the Fourth Circuit case and the First Circuit case, those cases, as I read them, involve district courts who just did categorically reject the guidelines. They were unable to point to any case. That the person should be sentenced in a below guideline sentence. Instead, they just said, relied simply on the criticism of the commission and other judges and the scholars who say, hey, this 100-to-1 ratio is unfair, it's unwarranted, it's unjust, it's not right.
Except at the street level, this is sort of a minimizing thing, when others could certainly argue that. Just as your client said, he's having to make money to supply his own addiction. And in the process, he's a street seller, very quickly addicting lots of other people, who then will be in the same position he is. The problem with crack is it's almost immediately addictive. And that's why it's so pervasive. So a street level person is not necessarily someone who is little guy doesn't mean much. What he's doing is creating a whole lot of people just like himself. And that is why Congress has reacted, I think. And so, the reason I refer to the concurrence, because it goes into other factors. The street dealer might actually shove it up if somebody analyzes it that way.
And I realize, Your Honor, that different judges may
interpret that, and that gets into the disparity.
Right. And there's no question that judges are going to view it differently, and there's going to be disparity in the district courts on what kind of weight to give to that particular specific offense characteristic. But the Supreme Court has recognized in Booker that kind of judicial discretion and that kind of judicial interpretation is a byproduct. It's a price we pay for the constitutionality of the guidelines. The guidelines cannot be binding, and it can't be construed as being mandatory in any way, shape, or form. Different judges might interpret the significance of those kinds of facts differently, but that's the price we pay for the constitutionality of the scheme. Court has no further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McKinley. Counsel for the governor has used the allotted time, and therefore, with our thanks to both counsel in the case will be taken under advisement. case of the morning is number 053953, United States against Stevens. Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Bill Daisy, Indiana Federal Community Defenders. The Court has now heard from three-fourths of our office this morning, and we're hopeful nothing important is happening in Indianapolis today. I represented Mr. Stevens at trial and continue as his appointed counsel on appeal. Mr. Stevens was charged with three counts of being a felon in possession of firearms and ammunition. He went to trial, was acquitted of a count charging that he possessed bullets, which police officers claimed to have retrieved from his pocket. He was acquitted, or he was convicted of two weapons recovered from a truck in which Mr. Stevens was a passenger. We raised with the court's sufficiency of the evidence arguments as to the weapons that he was convicted, and an Almendarez Torres argument as to the application of the armed career criminal statute to his case. I would suggest that the sufficiency of the evidence arguments are somewhat different than most cases involving a vehicle stop and guns or drugs recovered from the vehicle because the police had been under surveillance of the vehicle prior to the stop and had some clue as to what had been going on. As the court may have noted, the police officers were watching Mr. Stevens' brother's house because he had a parole violation warrant out. They observed a drunken Ralph Downing leave the truck, walk into the house, exit the house with two shotguns, two long weapons, place one bed of the truck, get into a suggest crowded cab of the truck with two other individuals with the shotgun. The government's witness, Gary Stevens, who was Mr. Stevens' brother, testified that Ralph had been in the house. Ralph had been waving a pistol around. That he, Gary, expected to be taken to the pawn shop to pawn his two long weapons, two shotguns, and that Ralph just sort of staggered off with his weapons, and they all drove away. We argue, I would desperately like the acquittal of the count involving the bullets taken from his pocket to mean something with reference to the sufficiency arguments here, but it doesn't, of course. Other than perhaps...
A discriminating jury.
They were rational when they took that action. I argue that they were irrational when they convicted my client of the other two weapons. And so, I say this, with reference to the shotguns, my suggestion is that the evidence is insufficient to conclude that my client had some requisite intention under a constructive possession argument to exert control. That is, the person the police, who, by the way, was a convicted felon and wasn't charged, the person the police knew brought the shotgun to the truck and placed it into the truck, to conclude that Mr. Stevens, from the fact that it was in the truck, had the requisite intention to exercise control over that shotgun. I would argue the evidence was insufficient to support that. The police know by the time they walk up to the truck, the vehicle, or that the shotgun is pointed toward the floorboard, the stock of the weapon is pointed toward the door, and it's effectively at Mr. Stevens' lap. But again, would argue, in the context of the entire case and what the police observed, that basing that conclusion, like some game of using the chairs, in what position the weapon happened to be at the time the police walked up to the truck is insufficient for a rational juror to base a conviction as to the shotgun.
Was that shotgun legal?
So far as we know, yes.
Wasn't a pistol handled shotgun?
No, so far as we know, they were both, they were both legal. It seems to me one of the two shotguns was a pistol grip type shotgun, but a lawful weapon. I think that was the one that struck bed. The pistol, of course, as I have to acknowledge, the jury was free to believe or disbelieve Brother Gary's testimony that Ralph was waving this thing around in the basement before he left the house and entered the car. But from the perspective of evidence before the jury from which they could conclude that my client, again, exerted some requisite intention to exert control over this pistol as it was found under the seat in which he was sitting. It was the testimony of the officer in some kind of a precarious position. And his view expressed in several different ways, but the thrust of it was that the pistol should have fallen over while the vehicle was in motion from the way he observed the pistol. And further, as he approached the truck, he testified that Mr. Stevens ducked as the police approached. We've cited cases in Linwood,